Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Today, we hear more from Governor Josh Green about the talks between the state and the Army on the expiring land leases. We also learn more about the invitation extended to the Pope to visit the islands. Public tours of Kalaupapa are to resume after being shut down during the pandemic. Could a visit from the Pope be in the future? We highlight a local sandwich shop making a decade of business as it goes viral in a new video series, and the owner does the math on tariffs. And we honohoe a recent interview about the importance of public radio and independent journalism. The National Park Service extended an invitation to local media to visit Kalaupapa for a preview of the public tours that will resume next week. It's been about 6 years since public access was opened to the settlement on Molokai. Kalawao County was set up as a refuge for patients with Hansen's disease or leprosy. And once the remaining six patients live out their lives, the responsibility will be transferred from the State Health Department to the National Park Service. We talked to the Park Service superintendent last week, and Governor Josh Green just returned from a trip to Italy where he met with Pope Leo XIV at the Vatican. And when we last spoke with Green before his trip, he indicated he was going to invite the Pope to come visit Kalaupapa, where two saints, Father Damien and Mother Marianne Cope, ministered to patients there. We talked to Green about that and about military leases that are set to expire across the state. Green said that he is hopeful that Pope Leo will come to Hawaii to visit.
He was an extraordinary individual to speak to. Jamie and I felt so honored to talk to the Pope. And this is what the Pope said to us. People of the world are struggling. You are all seeing people go through tough times. We should encourage them to ask for help. And those of us who have capacity should offer help. And I have the capacity to offer help, and a lot of people I spend time with have the capacity to offer help, and we're going to do it, and we're going to take that sermon to heart. And then I said to him humbly, please come to Kalaupapa. There are still six individuals that are living who suffered Hansen's disease, which is leprosy. That's in remission, of course, because they now get treated. Three of them are living full-time in Kalaupapa, three on Oahu, and soon the last of the patients will pass away because they're quite old. So I told him it's a sacred place. Hawaii is an extraordinary place, and we would be honored, whether people are Catholic or not Catholic, I think we'd be honored to discuss humanitarian needs. That's Jamie and my approach. We would like to do more humanitarian work in the coming years to complement the work that we get to do as the first family with policy. And so I think he'll come. I think it's likely to be 2027, maybe 2028, and I wouldn't be surprised if it comes on the tail end, say, of a North America trip or an Australia trip. So he's from Chicago. We were able to really communicate. We gave him some small gifts, and he was very kind.
Well, Bishop Silva did also extend an invitation just because of the anniversary coming up to mark the first Catholic priest coming to Hawaii and to acknowledge that history. And they were just saying, if you come, we'll take you any time you can fit us into the schedule.
Yes. We would take them next week if that was possible. But I think they have to do quite a lot of scheduling to move around. And it was extraordinary. So, yeah, so the bishop and I are going to work together on supporting his projects and also bringing the Pope here. Obviously, he would be our point person to welcome the Pope. And I like Larry. We get along. These are relationships that, as you can see, we're different people, Larry Silva and I. And needless to say, we're different than a lot of what's going on at the federal government level. But we're going to have to try to work things out. You know, the one thing that you haven't yet gotten to, and we'll spend a lot of time talking about it, is the leases, the military leases. And I'm going to do my very best to protect our land and our people. But the federal government does have the capacity, ultimately, if they chose to condemn the land and simply force us into a position where the land was just traded out. My take on this is I should make sure that we protect our land and our environment and get resources well in advance of any decision like that, to help us with energy and housing and transportation and, of course, sustaining the land and repairing the land with our local community so that we can restore Lakua Valley and we can restore the areas of land swap that may occur. That's coming up. It's going to get heated perhaps as an issue, but my position is to always make sure that we get the best possible situation out of these relatively contentious moments.
We understand that the University of Hawaii has just signed some agreement with the Army on the, I think, some of the conservation work and the projects that they've got going on out there on this island. But is it your sense that while the Army Secretary wants a resolution by the end of this year, that that could come that quickly?
Well, it could come that quickly. Here's the circumstance. In order to go through the process that's required at the Board of Land and Natural Resources and the input that we need from the community, it will take longer. If out of a national security concern, the Army and their leadership decide that they simply don't have that kind of time, there's nothing legally that we're able to really do to stop that kind of condemnation. I would say it would be a strategic condemnation of land, and I would hope and expect that they would honor all that we've asked of them, which is to help us restore the lands and do what we need to do on these other challenges we have, like we've been discussing, housing and water and so on. That's likely the best outcome. They may slow their pace a little bit. That's possible. I'm having lots of discussions with them about that. And I will be going back to D.C. for 2 days at the end of October, and I'll expect to have some very serious meetings. I'm also very possibly going to see the Secretary or the Deputy Secretary of the Army in a week back here. So it's ongoing. They, like I said, and I want people to really hear this, they do have, it turns out, the legal capacity if they chose to condemn lands and give us fair market value. But the fair market value is dwarfed by the need and the appropriate value of the land. And I know some people are going to say it should never happen, that the military should leave. I just want to be direct. That is not what's going to happen. The United States of America is going to continue to have some presence here, some presence. And we can work with them as an ohana. The people that are actually serving here, we have many dear friends in the military that are part of our community, or we can end up in a conflict that we lose. And I'm determined never to lose on behalf of Hawaii. And so that's where it is. It could happen this year. It really could. They could decide, because of the geopolitical concerns out in the Pacific, particularly with China and Taiwan, that this has to get wrapped up. And if it does, I want to be prepared to make sure we get the best possible resolution and deal that we can for our people, because otherwise it's a lost opportunity and we would lose out. And I think that is not something we can take when things are this tight.
And you support the idea of a land swap?
I would prefer that it go through the full process, of course. And a land swap is the only thing that will meet any of the calendar deadlines. And truth be told, and I am not saying this critically, any formal land swap that was engineered by the state and the federal government together would be contested in court. It would be delayed for years. And then I can absolutely guarantee you that they would condemn the land and we would lose out on any deal that we could possibly get. So it's one of those things. People are going to have to be very sober about the reality of the situation. If we take a purely activist position, because people just like to have some kind of a purity test on government and me, we'll lose. We'll lose our capacity to help heal the land. We'll lose our capacity to get resources. And some people do that for a living. They sue and they get us into contested hearings and then we get nothing. And you all and all our listeners have seen it. We somehow tie our own hands too often when probably we could have been moving forward in better ways to build more affordable housing, to get more water in place, to get better constructive deals that benefit our people in Hawaii. Instead, there are a lot of circumstances I could point to where we've litigated ourselves into oblivion. And people wonder why we don't have a diversified economy, and they wonder why we don't have adequate affordable housing for people that have lived here for generations. It is largely because of this kind of true purity test, which results in, unfortunately, hurting our own people. And on my watch, I'm just not going to do that. I'm going to be very thoughtful about how we navigate these issues and protect people and be thoughtful about the environment. But I'm not going to let other people outcompete us to our own harm and watch young families have to leave for the mainland. It's not the right thing to do. That's really a pretty comprehensive description of the struggles that we have day in and day out to get things done. We can do great things in Hawaii. We just passed the green fee. No one else has done it. It's going to help us a lot, but that's an outlier right now as successes go. And we could have similar successes on things like housing and healthcare if only we were working all together. And so I'd encourage people that way.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, Governor.
You bet. Take care.
Aloha.
Aloha.
That was part of a conversation we had with Governor Josh Green yesterday. He talked about the pressure to reach a deal with the Army on expiring military leases and also about the invitation he extended to Pope Leo, the first American pope to head the Catholic Church. Pope Leo's father's family is from Chicago, and his mother's family is said to be from New Orleans.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters' 15th anniversary celebration. Online now featuring Cono Noir, Kau Yellow Bourbon, and more. BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com/anniversary.
You know, it's almost lunchtime, and our next segment is about a sandwich. Well, Justin Parvizi Motla began Earl Sandwich Shops in a Kaimuki parking lot, and in the decades since, the sandwich shop has now expanded to three locations and more recently has become an internet sensation with a viral video series entitled $40,000 and a Dream. Take a listen to part of the first installment.
I'm Justin, and 10 years ago, I quit my job, cashed in my life savings, and decided to follow through on my dream of opening a sandwich shop in Honolulu, Hawaii. Here's how it's going so far. I moved to Hawaii in 2007 for school. After graduation, I realized I wanted to be a restaurant owner, so I made it my mission to gather cooking and managing experience. I knew I needed money, but wasn't really sure how much, so I began working as much as humanly possible. Turns out, if you rent from a shady landlord in a building that is basically falling apart, you don't need as much as you might think. 40K did the trick. So I spent it all and I went for it. I learned very quickly being a manager and being an owner were very different. The early years were challenging and awesome. Every day was a new experience. The thrill of building a brand from scratch was unlike anything I have ever experienced. But don't get me wrong, a bunch went wrong.
A bunch went wrong. Well, Parvizi Motla spoke with The Conversation's D.W. Gibson about those videos and the beginnings of his business.
I guess the story really starts when I moved here. I moved here back in 2007 for college. After I graduated school, HPU, I started like working in restaurants and stuff like that, trying to like gain experience. And I always knew that I wanted to open a restaurant. My father owned a restaurant when I was younger. So I was always like kind of quietly like working on my business plan, trying to like make those steps towards opening the store. And then in 2014, there was a tiny little hole in the wall spot in Kaimuki, maybe about 300 square foot, and it had a for lease sign in the window. And I called the number, the property owner, the guy that owned the building came down. We started kind of exchanging some information back and forth. And I said, you know what? I didn't think I was ready. I thought that I was years away from being ready for opening up my own business. But because the space was so small and because the rent at the time was pretty cheap, actually, it was only about $2,500 a month for the rent. I was like, okay, maybe I can like give this thing a try. So my dad was retired at the time, actually. And I called my dad, and my dad actually moved from Baltimore to Hawaii. And then for the first couple months, me and my dad actually ran the shop together, which is actually a pretty cool experience.
Working in the restaurant business is very different from opening a restaurant. Talk about that experience you had, sort of putting on that entrepreneurial hat.
I was like a restaurant manager. So I was like assistant general manager for some restaurants in Waikiki. And at the time I was like 25 or 26 years old and I was a little young, a little arrogant. I was like, all right, I'm a really good manager. Like I'm definitely going to be a great business owner. And that was not the case. Like I realized that like when you work for a big company, there's lots of support. There's lots of people wearing different hats and helping you. And one of the things I realized early on is now I have to be the marketing team. I have to do all the ordering. I have to make all the scheduling. I have to do basically everything. And it was definitely a big learning adjustment from going from restaurant manager to owner. I feel like I'm still learning stuff to this day, actually.
And if the dishwasher doesn't show up, guess who washes dishes?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I was even doing dishes last week. I still help out and assist in that capacity. And that's one of the things I really try to do and be about is like still being active and present in my stores and in my restaurants. You do see a lot of people after a certain amount of years, they kind of just phase out from operations. But that's the core of what we do is our customers, our community. So I always want to make sure that I'm there to support my team for sure.
Well, talk about that growth. I mean, it's been over a decade now, 2014. What does the business look like right now?
Yeah, so we started in 2014, And then for about 4 or 5 years, we just had the one location. So in 2019, we opened up our Kaka'ako store. And that was a really big moment for us because I actually had to do a full build out of the space. Like, it wasn't already a restaurant. So I had to get a bank loan, I had to work with the SBA. We had all the permitting and all that stuff. So that learning experience right there was crazy on its own. But figured that out. Kaka'ako is good to go. And now we opened up in Kapolei about a year and a half ago. So we have 3 stores. So from 2014 to now, we've been able to open up 3, and we have some other plans in the future, trying to open up some other stores, but nothing's official yet.
Well, and you've had a few viral moments of late, something about lobster rolls. Talk to me about how you feel about lobster rolls these days.
Oh, yeah. So I think for us, it's really important for us to like tell our story. And we try to want to find like fun and creative ways to do so. So instead of just kind of making like another like glossy like food promo video, we're like, maybe we have an opportunity here to do something fun. So we started a vlog series, which kind of documents like the progress of the company. Episode 1 was titled 40K in a Dream. That's how much money I had to save to be able to open up my business and start, which I think is cool because a lot of people might think that you need more than that. But that's all it took to initially get started. And then the second episode is about the lobster rolls, which, yeah, was kind of our first like viral moment where we first started to experience like lines out the door, phones ringing off the hook, all this stuff. But I kind of realized that like customers weren't necessarily there for Earl. They were there to get a taste of this like kind of trendy food item. And my mindset the whole time is like, what happens if this is not like sustainable? And we really wanted Earl to be kind of like a legacy business with a story to tell, something that I can give, pass down to my kids, and so on and so forth. And we just felt like building a business around that type of trend wasn't what we wanted to do. So hence the name of the second episode, we nixed the lobster rolls.
Now, customers can get very attached to expectations they have for restaurants and what they can get there. Did you face any blowback from that decision?
I mean, yeah, for sure. We actually do a lot of menu changes as well. So we've been open for about 10 or 11 years now, and we've changed our menu actually about 7 or 8 times. So from the time in 2019 when we opened in Kaka'ako, there's actually nothing on that menu that is on our current menu now. So yeah, every time we decide to do a menu change or take an item off of the menu, there's always some pushback, and we always try to be sympathetic and tell our guests sorry, but we always feel like it's in the best interest of the company long term, and we still have our core customers, and like new menu changes can help like bring in new customers and all this kind of stuff. But yeah, there was definitely some pushback. There were some one-star Yelp reviews. There were some people on the Instagram saying, I'm never coming back, blah, blah, blah. So we try to take that with a grain of salt, not take it personal, but yeah, for sure.
Are there some challenges that you've encountered that are unique or special to starting a business here in Hawaii?
I mean, I think, yeah, for sure. Like where I'm from the East Coast. I'm from like a small town right outside of Baltimore City. And like a lot of consumers and guests are always concerned about value. They want everything to be affordable and approachable and a good price point. And actually for many years, I've like spent time trying to work on that and be able to try to offer the products at a price that is good for people. But it is very challenging in Hawaii for us to use quality ingredients, good high quality ingredients, and also still provide that at a value. Pretty much everything I buy, almost everything I purchase, there's like cheaper alternatives. For mayonnaise, I could buy mayonnaise for half the cost that I buy it now, but I want to use Best Foods and Hellman's because I think it's the best. For steak, we use like USDA Prime top sirloin. I could get choice or select cuts or product. So that's a challenge, definitely the food cost. And also in Hawaii, commercial rents are very expensive. Where I'm from on the East Coast, if you want to open up a business, you probably just look into buying the building and purchasing the building. And you can do that for under $1 million and get that going. And now instead of having rent, you have a mortgage. But in Honolulu, that feat is almost impossible. That is extremely difficult for a small business owner or an entrepreneur to be able to do that. So those are definitely some challenges that we face for sure.
You know, and you were talking about product selection and always having something less expensive available to you. Talk about the last 6 months in terms of tariffs. Have you noticed changes there? And is it required any concessions on your part?
So oftentimes, too, when you're working with distributors, they are not going to up and tell you, like, the reason why the price is going up or it's because of a tariff. Like, so they aren't exactly citing these reasons why, but in the last 6 to 12 months, there has been significant price increases in products. An example of one product is about 12 months ago, I was buying, like, USDA Prime Top Sirloin for about $5 a pound. And now it's $10.20 a pound. So we sell a lot of cheesesteaks. That's what we're known for, you know. So just in 1 month on one product, we went from spending about $8,000 to $10,000 a month to about $20,000 a month. And this is just one product, you know. So this is happening with other products. And so it's definitely something to be mindful of. And we try to combat it. But like I said, it's definitely a challenge for running a restaurant in Hawaii.
Yeah, and I have to imagine that is a very delicate dance because obviously you don't want to pass everything on to your customers, but you need to find some space in the middle so you can keep your doors open.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly. I mean, you really have to make sure you're selling food at the proper margins. And this is one thing, like when I first opened up the business, that I definitely struggled with a lot. So an example is like, say a sandwich or something cost me like $4 to make. I'm like, okay, it's only cost me $4 to make. I can charge $10 for it. In my mind, I'm like, oh, that's like $6 profit on every sandwich. This is good to go. Well, no, this is just like 40% food cost, plus you have your waste and this and that. So now basically half of every dollar that you bring through the door is going towards food cost, not including rent, labor, all these other things. So now we try to use like food costing software and things like this to help us. Basically, we upload all of our invoices on there and we can build out our specs, and it helps us get a better sense of like what our margins need to be and what they are.
Well, any parting words for budding entrepreneurs out there in the islands? Any advice for them?
I mean, yeah, the restaurant biz is a hard biz. It's a stressful biz, a tough biz to be in. But at the end of the day, like if you can figure it out and like make it work, it's like extremely rewarding. And it's been really rewarding for me and my family. And I think anybody who does want to start a restaurant, the mindset should be like, just chip away. Like, you're not going to be able to accomplish everything overnight. It is going to take time. So don't get frustrated if it does take time. Like, it might take 10 years for you to open that restaurant and have some type of level of success. So if you're not ready to make that commitment, I would recommend doing something else.
And that was Justin Parvizi-Motla and HPR's D.W. Gibson. We'll have links to Earl Hawaii's viral video series, $40,000 in a Dream, on our website after the show.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's D-A-I-K-I-N, at CostcoHawaii.com.
You know, we like to honoho recent interviews that we find particularly engaging, illuminating, and educational during our membership campaign. The conversation C.W. Gibson spoke with Morning Edition host Michelle Martin just after Congress voted to rescind $9 billion that had already been allocated for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The move has upended the funding models for local television and public radio, and since then, public radio stations across the country have been scrambling to figure out how best to continue delivering the unflinching journalism that listeners have come to expect. So we took note when Michelle Martin made headlines this week following the assassination of Charlie Kirk. Martin's interview with conservative activist and lobbyist Matt Schlapp went viral, with many pointing to it as a master class in sticking to the topic at hand and getting straight answers. Here's a clip from their back and forth.
You know, people have ideas, and you know, might not like them. There's a lot of people whose ideas I think are abhorrent. But, you know, would I help them change their tire if they were on the side of the road? Hope I would.
But, you know, on Newsmax yesterday, you called on leaders of the left to stop normalizing hatred and violence. Are you also calling on leaders of the right to do the same?
Everyone should stop doing that. But the only difference is in the age of Trump is that, there has been a outrageous commentary that goes on and isn't stopped.
To 2 months ago, two elected Democratic state officials and their spouses were shot in Minnesota by a man who had a hit list of 45 elected Democrats he intended to kill. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband attacked in his home. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro's official residence set on fire. This would seem to be an equal opportunity problem, right?
I'm not sure it's equal, but I think there are examples on both sides that are repugnant. But I just want to, I want to chastise you a little bit here. Mm-hmm. Someone who's very close to my family and to the conservative movement was assassinated yesterday. We haven't seen really anything like this. Somebody who's not even in elected office. I don't think this is the right moment for you to say to me that I am not sufficiently concerned about violence that happens from anyone. I think this is a moment to reflect on the life of a young man who made a big difference, and a lot of people are mourning it.
Yes.
And it is the wrong time for you to start assigning blame and to say I should have better commentary.
Oh, forgive me, but didn't you surface that issue, and am I not listening to you?
I can understand why you're getting defunded. This is outrageous.
I'm sorry
this
that you
young
feel
man
that way.
This young man deserves some thoughtful appreciation this morning. He's
and
the father of two children.
And we certainly are giving him
that. And you're turning this into...
No, I think we're certainly giving him the attention he deserves. And this is NPR News.
And here is HPR's D.W. Gibson and Morning Edition host Michelle Martin. They spoke back in August.
We like to talk here at HPR about all the winding roads that can lead people to public radio. I'm curious, could you give our listeners just a little background on how you got here?
Sure. I started in newspapers. I had a summer internship at the Washington Post. I tell people I graduated on June 5th. I took my driver's license exam on June 6th. I drove to Washington on June 8th under supervision, thankfully. And the woman who had been my RA in college was also moving to Washington, thankfully. So we drove together, brave woman.
Yeah.
And I started at the Washington Post on June 10th. So I was a summer intern there. And at the end of that summer internship, I got what at the time, I don't know if they still have this, was like an extended internship that they had and kind of like an apprenticeship program. And after a year of it, it was supposed to be a 2-year program, but after about 9 months in it, they terminated that and gave me a staff job. Did all the things at the Post. You know, the Post is famous for political coverage, so I did a lot of that. Covered the county council, state legislature. Then went to the Wall Street Journal, where I eventually became the White House correspondent. And then after that, I went to ABC News, where I was for a number of years and worked on a number of shows. I worked mainly on two shows there, a show called Day One, a magazine show, and then I worked at Nightline with Ted Koppel. And then after that, came to NPR, and this is my third show at NPR. So yes, kind of those winding roads in Hawaii, right?
Right, and you got that driver's license, and you went right to the work. I mean, some people, you know, they try this, they try that, but you knew exactly what you were doing. I love it.
Well, you know, it's funny that analogy, because when I first came to the attention of NPR, they asked me if I would, the head of programming then was in charge of recruiting, he asked me if I would consider being a contributor to someone else's show at the time. And I honestly had no thoughts of saying this, but I said to him, this is true. He would back this up. I said, nope, I'm tired of being a passenger. I'm ready to drive.
Nice.
So when you're ready to give me the keys, I'm ready to drive. And he was like, oh. And I walked out of there thinking, what did I just do? But yeah, I worked out.
Fantastic. I think the public radio is defined by people who aren't afraid to get behind the wheel and drive. I mean, it's certainly an enterprising world. But I wonder, when people who know you and know what you do, know that you work in public radio, ask you how you're doing in regards to the loss of public funding, I wonder, how do you answer a question like that?
You know, it's so funny that you said that, because this is something I've been talking about. I'm glad we have a chance to talk about this. I was on vacation about 2 weeks ago, and then came back, was hosting, was on the show, and then I went to a journalism conference, and people were asking me, like, how are you doing? You know, are you okay? And I'm glad I have the chance to say, we're not going anywhere. We are not going anywhere. And I would think that people would know that, but I kind of understand why they don't. Yes, it is true that there has been a significant loss of funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which it's a big hit. You can't lose $1 billion in funding and have it not be a big hit. But the reality of it is, it's a small part of our funding overall. Yes, it's true that some of the stations are going to be hit harder than others. You know, some of our stations are in places that are certainly rich in culture. They are certainly rich in story, and they certainly serve a vital need, but they are in places that don't have a lot of excess capital that people can readily share. So that's where the public funding comes in, because it has been important over the 50-year history of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to be sure that people all over the country have access to this kind of work. But my answer is, we are going to continue to do what we do. We know what our mission is. Our mission is to report on what's important to our audience around the country and around the world. We're going to keep doing that. Obviously, we're going to have to figure out some new ways of doing that, but we have a learning mindset here. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I think that we have been successful over the years, is we have a learning mindset, and we figure out how to get the story where it is, and then how to bring the story to people where they are. And that is what we do. That's what we're going to continue to do. Like, for example, I was at this conference, and one of the people who's a very distinguished journalist, I'm not going to call his name, I was at a panel discussion. This journalist was asked, gee, you know, are there stories that aren't getting the attention they deserve? And he said, well, Sudan, you know, we just can't get in there. And I'm thinking, excuse me, I have been to Sudan. I was there last year I went with our then UN ambassador, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. We went through Chad. It took, you know, what? Almost like 23 hours to get there. We got there. We were at the border as refugees came across. Our colleague, Emmanuel Akinwotu, who's based in Lagos, has been to Sudan twice by now. So I was really interested to hear this journalist who works for a very well-resourced as any news organization is at this point say, well, you know, we can't get in. Well, we've been there 3 times.
Yeah.
So, you know, we are doing the work, and I'm just hoping that we are making the value proposition clear.
I think there's some kind of marriage there between, or analogy at least, between getting behind the wheel right after graduating and a learning approach to life and work. I think those two things come together in that story. I have one last question for you. We have 10% of our listeners here at HPR who support us. And as we've lost the funding from Corporation for Public Broadcasting, we've looked to double that. We want to get 20% of our listeners to support us. And so our approach is that we want all of our listeners to get one person to come to the party, 1+1. Do you have any advice for our listeners on how to get their plus one to come to the Hawaii Public Radio party?
You know, I think, TW, I think you probably know better than I what your audience, you know, wants to hear and what's appealing to them. But again, I'd make the value proposition. What are you enjoying? What are you learning from? What are you listening? What are the things that improve your life? What are the things that you want to know about that we can share with you, that we bring to you? I know I recently, yeah, I don't know if you did this interview too, that she used to work here. She's at the Washington Post, Sarah Kehlani Koo, who recently did a memoir.
Yes, I just spoke to her.
You just talked to her?
Yes.
Did you? Oh, that's awesome. And, you know, I'd known her for years. I had no idea of her backstory. I mean, I knew her as a great editor. Yeah. You know, she's a great editor. She's a great colleague. But what a revelation to find out that this person who sat like 6 feet from me had this incredible story. So magnify that times 10,000. That to me is the story right there. Like, you know, and what's it going to be if there aren't people to bring those stories to you? I think that's kind of how I like to think of it. You know, I don't know if you ever do this. Sometimes, like, if I have a moment and maybe if you have a chance to sit outside and, you know, people watch and you think, gosh, I wonder what story you have in there. Mm. Like, what story are you walking around with?
Yeah.
And if you think about it, that's our job, is to bring you those stories from people. Oftentimes, of course, we connect with people when they're at their worst day or their best day. But the other thing I really appreciate about public media is we don't just connect with you on your worst day or your best day. We connect with you in between. The things that are happening in your life that are just important and interesting. And that, to me, is those gray areas. That's not like the, you know, when a big, big, giant, crazy thing happens, everybody's going to rush there. Mm. And when, you know, something amazing happens, like, I don't know, somebody wins a lottery. I don't know. Think about it. You know, you're going to hear about it. But we're there for those in-between moments because we live where you live. And we have the benefit of this network across the country and, in fact, bureaus around the world where we can tell you what's happening across the street, across the county, across the state, across the country, across the world. I think that's the value proposition. I hope that people get that message, and I know you're going to help make that message real.
I couldn't have put it better myself at all. Thank you so much, Michelle. Really appreciate you taking the time today.
Well, thank you so much. And you know what? Next time, maybe we'll do an interview in your studio, right? Like, you know.
Come on over. We got room for you, for
okay,
sure.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that, you know, because I can't just show up when invited. Well, I would, but.
Consider yourself invited.
Okay.
Be well, Michelle. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
That was NPR Morning Edition host Michelle Martin talking to HPR's D.W. Gibson about the role of public media in the wake of federal funding cuts. Well, it was quite a show today. Thank you for joining us. I'm Catherine Cruz.